Meanwhile, Cliff Stoll's vigil wore on. He was obsessed with his hacker. All but the most basic housekeeping for the lab's computers was shunted aside, and the hacker seemed to get even more single-minded. It became clear to Stoll that this was no mere computer science student romping in an electronic playground. He had developed a keen interest in things military. Now he seemed to want to see files pertaining to intercontinental ballistic missiles and the Strategic Defense Initiative. Stoll watched him try with a persistent series of educated guesses to get into a computer at the White Sands missile range. Login. Guest. Password. Guest. Invalid password. Try again. Login. Visitor. Password. Visitor. Invalid password. Try again. Login. Root. Password. Root. Invalid password. Try again. Login. System. Password. Manager. Invalid password. Disconnecting after 4 tries. If it seemed that the hacker could cause some harm in the system he was poking around in, or if Stoll thought that the people in charge of the computer should know there was a hacker poking around in their data, he would call them. Perturbed and incredulous at first, they would close the hole that the hacker had used to climb in. So far, the hacker hadn't found any sensitive national security data, or at least Stoll didn't think he had, but it was almost certainly on his agenda. The hacker plaguing Cliff Stoll didn't seem to be much in the way of a computer genius. He was seldom inventive. In fact, his most remarkable trait was his plodding persistence. He created connection after connection, then, like a dog trained to sniff out drugs, systematically searched each system for military information. Long after Stoll had become overcome with fatigue, the hacker would continue twisting doorknobs. Stoll began to think the intruder might not be human at all. Could it be a robot? A computer programmed to look for military information? Stoll decided that it wasn't, simply because whatever it was made spelling errors. At first, Stoll believed the intruder to be somewhere on the Berkeley campus, but there was evidence against this theory. The hacker was very familiar with Unix, but his behavior showed that he didn't know anything about Berkeley Unix, a variation on Unix that was de rigueur in Berkeley. Instead, he was using the traditional Unix commands first developed at AT&T's Bell Laboratories. He was speaking Unix with a strong AT&T accent. From the high keep of various universities, Stoll had never had much cause to interact with the outside world. His view of things left little room for shades of gray. As Stoll saw it, scientists who engaged in pure research and divorced themselves from the military were on the right side. The CIA, NSA, FBI, and military establishment were, by contrast, sinister and shifty, not to be trusted. And so was this hacker. Not only was he inside computer systems that he had no right to be using, but he was robbing Stoll of his time. Time to spend on the work he had been hired to do, to help the lab's astronomers use computers to design their telescope. If his more forgiving colleagues were entertained rather than upset by teenagers who broke into computers, Stoll saw nothing to excuse. In something of a contradiction to his self-consciously liberal way, Cliff Stoll was, in the end, a bit of a crank. He saw the hacker as a dark foe, and he wanted to see him behind bars. If he was going to catch the hacker in the act, Stoll knew he would have to trace the telephone calls, and in order to trace them, he would need a search warrant. So Stoll did something that was at odds with his political sensibilities. He called the local FBI office. He explained that there was a hacker in his computer who seemed to have a taste for military information. He was surprised and upset by the FBI's response. The agency had far bigger things to worry about than a loss of 75 cents. The second call across the great academic divide to the nasty world of bureaucratic authority proved more successful. The Oakland District Attorney's Office was immediately interested. Stoll explained that the hacker was coming through one of LBL's TimeNet links. TimeNet's network ran all over the United States. The hacker could be calling LBL from almost anywhere. In order to trace the call farther than the Oakland TimeNet connection, Stoll needed help from the phone company, and the phone company required a search warrant. The Oakland DA took care of that. Pacific Bell, the local telephone company, traced the call from TimeNet to McLean, Virginia, and from there to MITRE Corporation, an MIT spinoff. MITRE is a Pentagon-funded research center. When Stoll confronted computer security managers at MITRE with the news that a mysterious hacker was using it on his way to supposedly secure military and university computers all over the United States, the MITRE officials swore it couldn't be true. Their computers were absolutely impenetrable, secured from the outside world, they claimed. But it turned out there was an enormous hole. The hacker was using a local area network. These networks tie computers within a building, permitting them to communicate locally at high speed. At MITRE, to slip around the side of the company's computer security protections, he would dial into a pool of modems at MITRE that were shared by the local area network, then use the same modems to dial back out again. The hacker used the loophole as his personal bridge to reach other computers. It was costing MITRE thousands of dollars in long-distance telephone calls, because when the hacker called from MITRE, he stopped network hopping and started dialing directly into other computers. He had also planted a Trojan horse program in the MITRE system that captured passwords as others typed them in and copied them to a hidden file he could retrieve later. MITRE's computer people were shocked by this discovery. They pleaded with Stoll to keep the whole matter secret. For the public to discover that a defense contractor engaged not just in classified work, but with contracts to build secure computer systems, had fallen prey to a hacker, would have been a disastrous turn. In exchange for that promise, Stoll coaxed MITRE out of its past month's telephone bills. From scrutinizing the telephone bills, he discovered that the hacker had been active for several months before Stoll had even detected him, for far longer than Stoll had thought. Stoll had already counted close to 30 computer systems the hacker had broken into. The number of attempts was at least 10 times that. Soon after the phone company had completed the MITRE trace, Stoll watched the hacker jump from LBL into the MILNET Network Information Center, a computer network directory information service, where he discovered 4 network addresses and telephone numbers for CIA personnel. The hacker wasn't actually inside a CIA computer. That would have been far more difficult, because those machines are not directly connected to public networks. But he seemed to be getting closer. Stoll wrestled for a moment with his conscience. Why consort with the establishment and alert the CIA to the electronic spy in its midst? Why not just drop the matter right there and let the hacker romp unchecked? But before he could do much more ruminating, Stoll was reaching for the telephone and calling the phone numbers the hacker had discovered. In contrast to the tepid response Stoll had gotten from the FBI, the CIA immediately dispatched 4 people to Berkeley to discuss the matter.